Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Oh, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. He's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and this is another episode of Improv Nerd, sponsored by, you guessed it, the good people at Hotel Lincoln. The next time you find yourself here in the city of Chicago, and you're looking for a cool boutique hotel that's close to everything, including the Second City, it's not only improviser-friendly, it's pet-friendly as well. Not many hotels can say that. Check out the official hotel of Improv Nerd, Hotel Lincoln. Our guest today is Horatio Sands, and you know him from his many years on Saturday Night Live. He was also a founding member of the Upright Citizens Brigade. He started at the I.O. Chicago in Second City, and this was really a cool show because we taped this at Columbia College in Chicago in front of about 250-plus Columbia College students, and that's the school that Horatio went to, and I also went to it too, and I, believe it or not, I graduated, and I graduated in marketing, but I sold out, I went where the money was, and I pursued a career in improv, and I loved being there. It was great being there, even though there was a lot of feelings that came up, and the best thing they did was they sent a Lincoln Town Car for my wife and I, and they drove us down from Evanston, which is a suburb north of Chicago, to the South Loop where Columbia College is. And we went up there and we met the president of Columbia College and all the other, the head of the theater department. And Kelly Leonard was there from Second City. He was a producer when Horatio was there. Now he's moved up the ladder and he's now like vice president of Columbia, of Second City. And his wife is there, and who I've always enjoyed, Ann Libra. We were there, and it was just really, really fun. And you know, Horatio in this interview, he talks about Second City. And I think about, you know, when I was growing up in high school, I knew when I was in high school, maybe a junior or senior, that I wanted to work at Second City. And when I say work at Second City, I didn't want to be a barback or a host or in the box office. I wanted to be on main stage. And I took, you know, I went to Players Workshop of the Second City, which is no longer, but that was the school that Second City had on their bulletin board as you walk down the stairs. And George Wendt had gone there, and Bill Murray had supposedly gone there. And so I did that, and then I went to study at Second City at the training center before they had the whole conservatory and all the, you know, writing programs and, you know, a million classrooms and stuff like that. And then I went to I.O., and always in the back of my mind, I wanted to go to Second City. And finally, I end up at the Annoyance Theater. I'm 27 years old, and I have and the Annoyance is this big hit theater. You know, it's not only a national, but it's local. And they're doing shows like The Real Life Brady Bunch and Co-Ed Prison Sluts. And I was doing a show, and I've talked about this before, called I'm 27, I Still Live at Home and Sell Office Supplies. And in the back of my mind, even though we're like the hottest theater in Chicago, and we are eclipsed Second City at that time, I want to get hired by Second City. I want to get hired by Second City. And then I joined this group called Jazz Freddy. I've talked about that, you know, and it's just this you know, epic long form show, and a lot of people get hired by Second City. And I make a huge mistake. I make a huge, huge mistake. I had just come back from a self-actualization weekend workshop. And I don't know what I heard or whatever, but when I came back, I wrote a letter to Kelly Leonard and I said, Kelly, I never want to work at Second City ever. And I sent it to him. And I remember I sent it off, and then a couple days later, because Dave Koechner, who was my roommate at the time, who was in Jazz Freddy, he came back and he said, "Oh my God, Kelly's upset because you have sent him this letter." And I felt good about it, you know, that I was like, I don't want to work at Second City, and I made it really clear, which was a total lie. But the sad thing is, I didn't even know it was a lie. The sad thing was that, you know, I was so into sabotaging myself that, you know, I was like, I wasn't even conscious that that's what I was doing. And I really shot myself in the foot, you know, and I really have a lot of regret for doing that. And then other members of Jazz Freddy got hired, and Dave eventually got me hired at Second City, but not at the theatrical side where the main stage and ETC and the touring companies were, but in what they called the business theater at that time. And they did corporate shows and corporate workshops, and occasionally they would do commercials and stuff. And I started working there, and I started as a writer, and then I was a performer, and I met a guy, Scott Allman. Scott Allman was working in the main stage, and Scott Allman was a great guy. He had a gruff kind of voice, and but if he liked you, he took care of you. And Scott really did take care of me, because you really had to hustle to get work at the business theater. So Scott says to me one day, after we had done a series of commercials that were really successful. They were a thing called Sports Vision, and Rachel Dratch was in it, and John Glazer was in it, and it was just, they were really fun to do, and it was a big honor, you know, but it was because of Scott. Scott pulled me aside, I remember, and he goes, "Hey, Jimmy, you really should be in touring company. Do you want me to talk to Kelly?" And I, like an idiot, I'm thinking in my head, well, I'm 33. Most of my friends are either in one of the resident companies on ETC or Main Stage, or some of them have even left. And I'm too old to tour. That's what I'm saying in my head. You know, like, I don't get married until I'm 47 or 48. So it's not like I had, you know, a wife and kids. It's not like I had a lot of friends back then. I had, my life was tiny. And so I say, "Scott, no, I'm not really interested." The prideful, stupid self of Jimmy Corrine says no. Now, I don't know what would have happened. I honestly don't know what would have happened. But it's just like, I look back, and it's just like, how stupid was I, you know? How stupid was I back when I was 27 years old? I think you're really going to like this interview with Horatio Sands, because he talks about how he got started. He talks about the Upright Citizens Brigade. He's got a great story about one night when they were doing kind of street performance here. He talks about Saturday Night Live, which I thought was great. And he talks a little about his drinking and stopped drinking and his weight loss. And we go all over the place, but I really appreciated it. And anytime I do an interview with somebody that I start out with, we also talk about jealousy here, which is, he has a really good take on it. So I think you're going to enjoy this. And I was just going to say, anytime I do an interview with somebody I start out with, there's always feelings the next day, and there's sadness. There was a melancholy when I was done with this interview, even though we were treated like rock stars. And on the way home, when I'm sitting in the Lincoln Town car, I'm like, "Get me out of here." But it was a really fun interview to do. I hope you enjoy.
Oh yeah, Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh yeah, Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh yeah.
Please help me welcome Mr. Horatio Sands. Okay, can we start for just a second? You said that you were shocked that Columbia, or surprised that Columbia College called you to do
yes.
this. Why would you be surprised?
Because I don't feel like I was a big success here.
Mm-hmm.
Because I came here initially for film and television, and I discovered soon after that the people that I was taking class with were much better than I was.
In film and television?
In film and television.
Okay.
Like, you know, you had to put together like a Bolex camera in a dark closet.
Uh-huh.
And some people were really good at it, and I'm like, these are the people I'm going to be competing with, so I don't know. I don't think I'll be good at it. So then I started taking acting classes here.
And then, but in the back of your mind, you always thought improv was you wanted to do improv. Where did you get that idea?
Well, when I was a little kid, I loved Saturday Night Live.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew that those, you know, Belushi and Bill Murray were from here, and they went to Second City. So that being the case, like, Chicago's very proud of its sons.
Mm-hmm.
So I always knew that, you know, that's where it happened. Second City was the place. So I used to go there when I was little. And I always had it in the back of my mind, but it seemed like a pretty crazy dream.
So you take this acting class here at Columbia.
Yeah.
And something changes.
Well, it changed, yeah. It changed.
And what changed?
Well, once the dream became something I thought I could attain. Mm-hmm. I just thought I can do it.
And what gave you that confidence in that class?
I went to an Improv Olympic show mm-hmm. on Wells. I think it was at
Topo Gigio, yes.
Yeah. And I saw some of it, and I was like, I can do that. A little cocky, but I just saw that, and I was like, okay, I can do that. And I took classes and started hanging out with people like you and drinking and hanging out. And then that kind of became the school.
Drinking part did?
The drinking was a big part of getting your chops. I wouldn't tell people to do it. But certainly at that time in Chicago, that's where the great people were hanging out.
At the bars?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Doing bits, dying, getting stabbed.
Right.
You know, we'd stab each other and pretend to die. That was a big one.
Yeah. The other thing that is that your parents, you were born in Santiago, Chile, correct?
Yes.
And your parents were immigrants. They came here. And they were big comedy fans.
My dad was mostly. He would show me. Also, growing up here in Chicago, it was great because you had all the great TV. Like, PBS would play Ernie Kovacs and Monty Python, the two Ronnies. You know these guys.
Sure, sure.
And it was a very cool education to be, like, really young and to watch that and to also have, you know, late-night TV, the Marx Brothers. I slept in my living room. That's mm-hmm. another part I didn't tell anybody.
Okay.
There wasn't room enough for me in the house, so I had to wheel out of bed and sleep in the living room. And the good thing about that was I got to watch TV, and then everybody would fall asleep, and I'd still be up watching television. So I got to see, like, Marx Brothers and old great movies.
What kind of kid were you?
I was the baby, and I think I was a little spoiled.
And you had a couple brothers?
I had brothers that were older, 6 and 9 years older.
Okay.
So for my parents, I think I was an accident, but a pleasant one.
Did they ever bring this up? How did you figure that out?
No, they would never say that.
Right. They're proud people.
Very proud
yes,
people.
Yes, yes.
And so when I grew up, I kind of had to be kind of charming to hang out with them. You know, I had to kind of speed up how I was funny to hang out with them and their friends. I would make their girlfriends laugh, stuff like that.
But you also said that you performed in the family. What kind of stuff did you do with your brothers?
I put, like, cotton on my face, like cotton balls. I would, you know, glue them on my face, and I'd be like a old captain or something. Uh-huh. And we'd treat the doorway of their bedroom like the stage. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, we put on different costumes and do bits.
What is your fondest memory about being at Columbia? Do you have one?
Well, the great thing is that I came here with my brother.
Okay.
So my brother and I would make...
So he enrolled too?
Yeah.
Okay. And what was his major?
I don't know.
Okay. Did your dad just write the checks? Did you have to pay for college?
Eventually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you think when
Columbia... I would like to get into this.
Okay, let's. Okay.
It was pretty expensive at the time.
Right.
And I went to this place called Espita.
I don't know what that is.
It was a little organization that would get funding for people from the inner city.
Okay.
So then I acted like I was real inner city.
Did you go in, how would you act like you were inner city?
I just, like, I'm poor.
Okay.
So they would get you these scholarships, but somehow mine was filed wrong. So for many years I had a woman called Miss Brown. They would call my house and harass me and tell me, like, you know, you owe $2,000 to Columbia College, and you're going to pay because we're going to find. And so it was, like, really funny. This woman, Mrs. Brown, was really, like, it caused me pain in my life. But eventually I paid it off, and I think after SNL, actually. But pleasant. It was just great to be here and to know that all these people were, like, going to be in entertainment, that all this fuss was over something dumb like entertainment.
Right. And what happened to your brother?
He just, I don't know, he fell out. He started working in some business and stayed there for a while.
You started at IO, you get hired at Second City. You were also a founding member of the Upright Citizens Brigade.
Yes.
When you guys started here in Chicago, what was your mission?
Well, our mission was to to bring something very different from what was happening. So I think we just thought that we would do something really good but different. I think everyone needs to have that too. I think people starting out need to kind of have a, not a disrespect, but kind of a ownership of that we can do better. But if for no other reason, it's just because we have the people there to show us what they were doing, and so now we could be better than they are.
But your stuff was almost like performance art on the street, and there's a story where you get arrested. Do you want to tell that?
Yeah. We would do this scene called Thanksgiving Dinner, and all it was it was us on four different corners throwing a soccer ball to each other.
And when you say us, it was Adam McKay,
Matt Besser,
Matt Walsh.
Matt Walsh, Ali Farnakian.
Was Amy?
Amy wasn't part of this
Amy
yet.
Amy Poehler was not yet. Okay.
Not yet, yep. And so we would just sit on different corners and throw a football around, or a ball, and just be like, pass me the potatoes, and we'd throw the potatoes. And it was just basically an excuse to do a scene out in the street. And then eventually we turned it into I would get hit by a car. And then in the car was Adam McKay driving and doing a video. So later in the show, you'd see me getting hit by a car. And they were like, wow, we were there and saw that. And then like they edited it and played it at the show. And one of those times, when I was supposed to get hit by a car, well, that was one of the bits. I always got hit by a car, and It was on video. But one time we did a virtual riot. So in the audience, we were going to take the whole audience and show them a real riot. They were going to be a part of a riot. And this is time when Dan Rostenkowski was having a little trouble. And so that's him right now. we had torches and fake guns, and we were saying, like, kill Rostenkowski.
Real torches with, like...
Some real torches, some fake ones.
But you had... Fire was involved.
Fire was involved.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Do you remember what neighborhood you guys were doing this in?
This was on North Avenue at Urbis Orbis in Wicker Park.
Okay, so Urbis Orbis was a kind of hipster coffee house at the time.
Yeah,
okay.
And we did our show in the basement.
Okay.
And so we would take the audience out, and we were doing a virtual riot, and I got onto North Avenue, and traffic stopped. And I didn't think
there's this big crowd, right?
Yeah.
With torches.
And I didn't think that would happen. I was kind of impressed by it. But I had stopped traffic on both sides of the street, and eventually I saw the blue light hit my face, and I made the decision, like, I have to get arrested, because...
That was a choice.
Yes.
For the people listening, that was a choice.
That was a choice.
An acting choice.
Yeah, because for that audience, if I would have apologized to the police officers and gone back into the theater, it would be less of an experience than if I would actually be taken away by the police, and then the audience would think, oh my God, how'd they get the police to pick him up?
Right.
So I was pretty brave.
Right.
When I was arrested.
Right.
I was like, fight the power! Fight the power! And the door closed and the police car shot away. So they must have been like, how the hell did that happen? And then there was a video of it taken by Adam McKay.
Right. And in the meantime, you're being hauled off to the police station, right?
Yeah. And so they finished the show.
Right.
They recast my parts.
Uh-huh.
They don't bail me out. But immediately... As the car was pulling away, I was like, I'm so sorry. I'm an actor. We were just acting. We were just doing sketches. And they just didn't talk to me. And the police car went to, I think, Arandas.
Which was
Mexican place.
On Western there.
Yeah. They went there. They left me in the car.
Mm-hmm.
They had dinner.
Mm-hmm.
They came back, and they're like, what the hell was that? I'm like, it's just an acting thing, a sketch. I'm like, well, we're going to have to arrest you. So they arrested me, and I got out the next day. But I still have video of it, and it's great. I'm glad I did it. It's a good story.
Now, we were talking just backstage about your reputation, because you know, we were around the same time. And you were known for getting in a little trouble. And I remember a story of getting... at Second City with the you and Noah Gregoropoulos, who's a wonderful teacher and improviser, you broke into Second City with the beer taps. Do you remember this story?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to go there? Or?
Yeah, I want to go there. We'll go through all my criminal history.
All right.
But My boss was here at the time. He was very cool not to fire me. Mm-hmm. We broke into... But let me just say,
first off,
it was the stage manager, both stage managers from the theater.
Okay, who were they?
Craig Taylor and Aaron.
Who just celebrated 35 years at Second City.
Great 35 years.
Yeah. I always thought his official name should be Craig Taylor on Lights. Because that's they always say at the end of the show, Craig Taylor on Lights. Just make it your official name.
It should be Craig Lights.
So go on.
So one night we're drinking heavily at Ale House or somewhere, and I think the bar was about to close.
Which, let's just tell the people, it's a 4 o'clock bar.
It is.
Okay.
So, you know, it was a pretty heavy night.
Right.
It was one of those nights.
Yeah.
And we didn't have our fill.
Mm-hmm.
And so Craig knew how to open up the taps because he'd been there forever. And he actually installed a video camera. He had done that like a month ago.
Uh-huh.
And I guess he seemed to forget that he installed a video camera.
Right. Well, let's just say, in his defense, he was pretty drunk too, right?
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
So at that time, there was another theater like above Second City. I forget what it's called, but they were doing that show, Song of Singapore.
Okay.
A big
Black
40s
Orchid.
Musical.
Black Orchid. Yeah, it was the name of the theater. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they had closed down, mm-hmm. but they still had all their beer and wine and stuff. Right. So we crawled up through the back and took some beer and wine and some bottles. And it was me, the two stage managers, and two waitresses.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were on camera. Then, you know, the next day, they're like, we have video of you guys breaking in here. Stealing bottles from upstairs. I didn't take any bottles, Kelly. Just for my defense. There was like, you guys have to go to rehab.
It was you and Noah, right?
It wasn't now, Noah, actually. It was me, Craig, and Aaron.
Great. One second, because Kelly's here. Did you sit them down and say this? They had to go to rehab?
It was actually Andrew.
Okay, Andrew Alexander.
Yeah.
Okay. What's his title at Second City now?
CEO.
Okay. All right. So he sat you
He's
down.
He's the Guy Caballero.
Right.
The Guy Caballero of
yeah,
Second
okay.
City.
That's an SCTV reference.
Yes.
Okay, so they sit you down and say you have to go to rehab?
He's like, listen, we've had some tragedies here. You know about them. We don't want this to continue. And so, we're not going to fire you, but yeah, we want you to go to rehab. And so I told everybody, don't go to rehab. If we all say, let's not go to rehab, they won't make us go. And so everybody was on board except Craig. And so Craig, you know, Craig was there for so many years, he really had a lot to lose. So he decided to go. And he went to rehab, and he was really mad that none of us had to go to rehab.
But let's say this. You have stopped drinking.
Yeah.
You don't drink.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, because we're going to segue into the Saturday Night Live. What do you think, how do you think things would have played differently?
Had you gone to rehab?
Yes. Or not drank?
That's really hard to tell because so much of drinking was, I mean, the improv scene was so much about
drinking. Can I ask you this? Do you think it ever got in the way of being at Second City or Saturday Night Live?
No.
You don't?
I don't, actually. I don't think it got in the way. I think later it probably got in the way of doing other things, but at that time...
In terms of what?
In terms of work after SNL, you know, I think, like...
What it said in Wikipedia was that, and I'm just doing this to cover myself, that it was a budget thing. After 8 years, they couldn't afford to have you on the show anymore.
That was pretty much it, yeah.
Okay. Was it a hard thing to lose that job?
No. I expected it. I didn't expect it to happen that way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just started getting calls like, what's it like to not be on the show anymore? So
what,
no one told
friends
me.
Friends and family?
No, but newspapers.
Okay.
So that, you know, that could have been handled a little nicer. Like, I actually walked to Lauren's office and said, I think I'm going to leave next year, but, you know, I want to do Update. And if I don't, then I think that'll be my last year. And so he said, no, let's not talk about quitting. don't talk, let's not talk about it. And then, you know, and then later they're like, newspapers are calling me and saying, what happened?
So Lauren never said anything to your face?
No. But later I found out that it was like, they would have probably taken me back if I'd agreed to take less money. But that seemed like a sign to get going.
But I also heard that you said that you wanted to, you in retrospect, you would have wanted to quit earlier the show.
Yeah, I think I rested on my laurels a lot. I mean, it was fun because it was, the more you're there, the easier it gets.
In what way?
You just don't have to prove yourself. People are writing for you. You're a lot more comfortable. You know, you're not performing. Like, in the first couple of years of SNL, very difficult because you're always worried about getting fired.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're there for 5 years, you know everything. You know how to, like, the writing becomes easier. Like, I would write, and I wouldn't go to rewrites. So we learned shortcuts, and it got very, very easy. But it kept me from working on the next level.
So going back to this period where I think the drinking got in the way after that, was it, oh, I got fired, I have nothing to do, so I'm just going to get drunk every night?
No, it was getting drunk every night anyway.
Okay.
I mean, it was like I was going through SNL getting drunk probably like 4 or 5 nights a week, but not on days where I had to perform. So it was very functional.
Mm-hmm.
So I basically just was doing the same thing except not working. so it just became more troublesome.
And was that an opportunity there once you left the show that you could have gotten more work?
Probably, yeah. But I don't know. I was just in a very weird place where I wasn't working.
Were you depressed? I would have been totally depressed.
I was depressed and kind of wanting to take it easy. Because at that point, it'd been... you know, 12 years of constantly just making that the number one thing in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So afterwards, it was just pretty freeing also.
What was the most surreal moment on the show for you? Like, when you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm doing this.
It was my first show, and Leonardo DiCaprio wanted to meet me. And someone said, Leonardo DiCaprio wants to talk to you. I'm like, that's great. And then they came back later, and like, Leonardo DiCaprio wants to talk to you. I'm like, what? So they take me to Leonardo DiCaprio, and he's like, that thing where you died was very funny. he's like, I'm a fan of the show. I'm like, welcome to the show. I'm really happy you're here. Like, really beautiful thing. And that was my first show. And that's probably, like, the moment where it all came, like, well, this is huge, right afterwards. Yeah, everything changed, like, right afterwards.
And who was the best host you ever worked with?
Well, Alec Baldwin is probably the most skilled.
Mm-hmm. In what way?
Like, he could have been in any cast at any time. He's just really funny, really good impressionist, kind of gets it. And it's surprising that he doesn't have any, like, improv background, because he really did get it. And I thought he could have been a cast member any time. I was very lucky to work with Bill Murray. That was a dream come true, and he was very gracious and...
Because Murray has a reputation, he can be a little curmudgeon.
Yeah.
Did you see that side of him at all?
I did, but it was great.
Okay, in what way?
Well, because, you know, at SNL, there's certain things that just run the way they have run forever because that's just the way it was, but they don't need to. Like I was discussing this earlier, like getting, like writing at 4 a.m. It doesn't have to be done that way, but they do it that way. And in the same respect, you know, the director at the time would kind of fall into the same habits. And so, you know, one time we were rehearsing a sketch, and she's like, Bill, can you move over to the couch? And he's like, no. I think it's good here. And then he would tell them how to do it so that it would be better. And so for me, that was great because he was giving them shit.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very gracious to me. He let me be the lead in a sketch. And so for me, it was just seeing a hero. And, you know, you give people that
right.
When they're that good.
The other thing is that he doesn't stick to a script. He improvises. Did you experience that, too?
No.
Okay.
No, not so much.
I read that on Wikipedia. who was the worst host?
I hate to bring it up. I hate to talk
Go
about
ahead.
It, but I'm going to.
Please. We're in Chicago.
No one's going to...
Yeah, no.
Because the guy, who's very nice, is Tom Green. And he...
For people who don't know Tom Green.
Tom Green was an MTV guy, and he would do pranks on his parents, and was just kind of a loud, crazy dude who would, like, you know, shoot his parents with fire extinguishers and stuff. And and paint dick and balls on their car and stuff like
right.
this.
Yeah. yeah.
And so he came onto the show, and just to, instead of kind of like just being a part of the show, sometimes the mistake people make is they try to make the show their own mm-hmm. and try to make it their style. And what happens is you're kind of saying to everyone who's there, you know, it's kind of like a fuck you. Like, I got it. I brought in some of my guys, and we're going to do some. So he kind of, for whatever reason, was kind of undermining sketches and kind of just trying to make everything weird. And for that reason, like, he brought in some writers. And so whenever you come in to SNL and you bring in your writers, it's kind of like saying, like, thank you, but I have to bring these guys. So it already starts out kind of weird. And so he was kind of, it was just like, it's already a difficult thing to do, and he was kind of making it more difficult.
What are some of your favorite characters that you did on the show?
Aaron Neville.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron Neville was one of my favorites. I did a character called Vasquez.
Mm-hmm.
And Vasquez, he talked like this. And he'd ask people, did you get laid? It was based on some Puerto Rican dudes I knew here in Chicago. The first sketch I wrote was after 9/11. And he was talking about Ground Zero and then asking people if they got laid.
What was doing that show like?
Oh, the show from 9/11 show?
Yeah, because...
It was really great. Because we really were angry and hurt. And it was kind of like we're getting our chance to, like, fight back a little. For me, it seemed like a personal thing of, you can't shut the city down. We're going to show you that you can't shut the city down, that you can't stop us. And I really did feel like it was bigger than just a show. To prove to the world that these guys are still trying to be funny and goofing around, and 3,000 people were murdered 2 weeks ago.
But was there fear before, like, maybe it's too soon, where can we go with this?
I don't know. I don't know if Lauren or if the producers felt that way. Certainly, we were ready to go. I think we were excited to do it. I think it was personal, like a personal way to heal, too, was just to get back to what we were doing.
Something also I want to talk to you about is you breaking up on the show.
Yeah.
Okay. You were known for that. People know that Lorne Michaels didn't like that. Did Lorne ever say anything to you?
Lorne never told me not to, because I would have stopped. If he would have said, I'm firing you, mm-hmm. stop laughing at yourself.
Mm-hmm. But I mean,
I would have
honestly,
stopped.
Raj, you did that here at Second City, too. You were known for breaking on
yeah.
stage.
Milking. I always like milking an audience,
uh-huh.
milking for laughs.
Uh-huh. How do you milk? Give me a technique for our listeners and people out here.
Basically, you just wait. You wait till a lot of people laugh, and then you don't say your next line until you've gotten enough laughs. You know?
Are you doing anything? You're not mugging or taking or anything?
Oh, yeah, you're mugging a little
okay.
bit, sure.
You know, this is part of, you know, instructional, so if we're going to put this information out there, we want people to follow through on it.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
First off,
okay.
I do find myself funnier than most people.
Okay. I mean, during the day...
So you have to understand, I'm listening to the comedy as people are listening to it, and I'm also finding it very funny.
Mm-hmm. So during the day, do you make yourself crack up?
No.
Okay.
I don't...
So it's only on stage?
You know what, though? It's pretty sad, I guess. But sometimes when people come over, it'll come up that, like, oh, you have to see Debbie Downer. And so they'll commandeer my computer and show Debbie Downer.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't watch it. That's too weird.
Why?
I just don't like watching myself and other people watching me like, are you laughing? You like it?
Okay.
So I kind of take myself out. I'll look the other way and I'll listen.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll still find it very funny.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, I will laugh at myself still. I'm surprised. I'm surprised at how funny I am. to myself.
So good.
You know, like you figured after 5 years I'd get over it.
Right.
But no, I still...
And that you know all the tricks and you're not going to surprise yourself.
Yeah, but I do. I do.
So Lauren never said anything to you?
I think Lauren may have said, like... something was funny out there. I'm like, and I think I said, yeah, I swallowed a clown. it's something my mother used to say. Like when we were little and we'd laugh at, and I couldn't stop laughing, she'd go, what, did you swallow a clown? So that's all I could think of when Lauren said that. But Lauren didn't, he was kind of like, something was funny up there, huh? It wasn't like, don't do this. And he never, like, I knew that he didn't love it, mm-hmm. but he never told me to stop. So I didn't feel like I should.
Did you ever get that note at Second City, not to break on stage?
I think so.
Did you, Kelly, did you ever give him?
Absolutely.
Okay. And how, do you remember how he took it? Do you think? Okay.
I just think that Second City and SNL. I mean, there's ways to look at those sketches, and you could look at them and be like, oh my God, the writing is so perfect, the lighting, the set, you know. And that was never really my interest, either at Second City or SNL, was to make the perfect sketch. It was more just to like bring an energy to the theater and to the show mm-hmm. that was. Unpredictable or a little crazy. Mm-hmm. And so, like, as long as I showed that and I could feel the energy and the audience is laughing, I didn't really feel I was doing anything wrong.
Do you think that might have hurt, has affected your career? I mean, because you are a great actor. You're not only very funny, but you're also a really good actor. And I wonder if the breaking up at Second City and SNL...
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it that energy that I had on stage and on TV, it's kind of hard to separate what would have happened if you would have never laughed at yourself. It's hard to tell. Maybe I wouldn't even been there if I didn't laugh at myself. I think I just, even the energy of performing and being amused by yourself is taking you to another level.
But when you get a movie or a TV part, Big Lake was the sitcom you did, You're not laughing there, right?
No, it's very boring to do movies and television because people are told not to laugh. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of going against what's naturally made you kind of successful. So you're like, don't laugh. No one laugh at this person, and then we'll laugh afterwards. So it's very weird, you know. And so that movies and television have always been more. Have been a little stranger for me and not as much fun as, like, the stage.
Mm-hmm. Are you ready to improvise now?
Yeah.
Okay. So we want to take an occupation, and we also want to take a...
Location.
A location. So could we get a location?
Something that fits on this stage. Doctor's office?
Doctor's office, okay.
Classic.
Okay, great. All right, so we're gonna. So you heard doctor's office. What goes on in your head?
I'm a patient.
Immediately.
Yeah.
Okay, great. And then what else did you want to take? Is that enough?
We got an occupation?
Deli owner.
Deli owner? Thank you very much. Hello, doctor.
Yes?
You have very nice couches.
Thank you. We just got this remodeled.
It's a lovely office. I'm afraid to go to doctor usually, but I was forced to.
I know. Your wife called me. She told me.
Yeah.
She said you're having problems with your lungs.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's not as much as like my lungs, as much as like what I'm doing to them. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I don't think it's a problem that's already there. I think I'm causing it.
I would agree with you. And the last time you were in, we talked about you stopping smoking.
Yeah.
How are you with that?
I'm not good at that. So I'm smoking a lot, and when I'm not smoking, I'm eating the meats there at the deli. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I eat so fast that I am actually inhaling the meat. I can't stop working at the deli, you know.
I understand that, yes. But I am concerned for your health.
I am too, believe me.
No.
That's why I'm
well,
here.
Well, I, to be honest with you, We do this every week. I'm getting to the...
I have good insurance.
Yeah, great. That's great. That's
you
great.
Wouldn't think so from the deli.
No,
but
no, you wouldn't.
That's why I'm there, honestly. Yeah, yeah. Who wants to work at a deli?
Well, your father does own it.
That's true.
So I'm worried about this because I don't think you're taking this seriously.
Why?
Because last week I found the spot on your lung.
A real spot or like a piece of meat?
Well, I went over the x-rays and it was a spot and there was a piece of meat lodged in there. I've never seen that before. Would you know anything about that?
Yeah. I ate a piece of tar. And then I ate a piece of meat right afterwards. And I think that's probably what you're seeing.
Okay.
A chunk of tar in my...
Look, I don't mind the meat. But we went over the tar. Okay?
I can't get enough tar from cigarettes.
I understand that. But to go and buy tar go to Home Depot and buy tar and eat it just out of the can, like watching TV, that's not helping your health. Now, I am your doctor, and I'm very concerned about your condition here.
Have you tried it?
George, I do it at social occasions, all right? I don't have a problem with it. You have a problem with it.
Why do you... How come I have a problem with it and you don't have a problem? We're both eating tar to get off. Am I right?
You're absolutely right, okay?
So it's hypocritical of you to say, don't eat tar, quit eating meat so fast, stop smoking, when you yourself are doing the same kind of things.
George, all right, you're absolutely right, okay? I am a total hypocrite.
Thank you.
Okay? But that doesn't change the fact that your health is deteriorating.
This is very...
No.
Very sad.
Yes. I think you should take this seriously. Now, I went over your records. And if you don't stop this...
Do you have an x-ray?
Do I have an x-ray?
Yeah.
Yes, I do have an x-ray.
Can you place it in front of the light?
I would be happy to. You think that's funny, don't you?
I do.
Making me get up and get the x-ray.
I do.
You know?
I'm sorry.
All right, here.
Perfect.
It's funny,
very nice
isn't
way
it
of putting that.
Death is funny, isn't it, to you? Is everything a joke?
It has to be. It has to be.
I had
be.
A guy who
That's
came
why.
In here. I had a guy who would... Everything was funny to him. He made himself laugh.
Okay, that's a good way to be.
You know where he is now?
Where?
He's dead.
From this whole laughing?
Yeah.
That's a good way to die.
What is?
I'm happy for that guy.
Are you?
I would like to die laughing.
Well, you know what? You're going to have an opportunity if you don't change what you're doing. Now, let me show you this. All right, you see this? This is your lungs, okay? Here's the tar that you shoved in there. I don't know how you got it in there, but it's there. All right?
Now, small incision. It's a tiny incision.
You're cutting
chest.
Yourself as well?
Yeah.
I'm going to have to write that down. All right. Now, see these things? It looks like whiskers coming off the tar.
Yeah.
You know what that is?
Whiskers? Sorry, what is that?
That's pastrami. Shaved pastrami. Now, if we don't take that out, the condition is just going to spread. All right? The tar is going to get hard. It's going to be like a golf ball. It's going to drop into your lung. All right? And eventually choke you with the pastrami. Imagine the pastrami like a little noose, all right? The tar ball is your head. It's like a little suicide inside your lungs. But the sad thing is about... You find that funny?
Yeah.
What's so funny about that?
A pastrami noose is funny. You can't say it's not funny. Saying that...
I've taken an oath. I can't say that's funny.
But you know it's funny.
Inside I do, but I can't admit it to my patients.
Okay. Well, then you know that I know that I know.
Okay, fine. So?
I'll stop the tar. I'll stop cutting myself and putting little tar balls inside my lungs.
Will you
pastrami
really?
Pastrami thing is
Will
hard.
You really?
Yeah, I'll do that. Mm. I'm not going to stop sniffing pastrami or whatever.
You're you know? Stiffy pastrami too.
I'm sniffing meats. That's how they get in my lungs, yeah. I shave them very thin. So the consistency is like cat food. And have you ever sniffed cat food?
I can't admit it because I've taken an oath.
But I know.
And you know.
But I know.
Yes.
You know that I know.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'll stop the tar and then we'll just do the best with the pastrami.
I need you to do more than the best with the pastrami. If you don't stop, you're going to die.
Okay.
Usually
that's okay.
When, that's okay.
That's okay. I'm ready to die.
Well, why don't you start at the beginning and say that? You just wasted 10 minutes of
I'm
my
sorry.
Time.
It's not the first thing you want to admit when you go to the doctor's office. I want to kill myself. But that's pretty much it. I want to kill myself, and I don't want to do it right away. So
how can I help? Let me help. I feel so helpless, like I haven't helped you over the last 4 or 5 years. Let me help with this.
You could prescribe me some drugs.
No problem. No problem. I would say probably a muscle relaxer. If you took 4 or 5 of those.
I don't want to.
What?
I don't want to poo myself or anything.
Okay.
You know what I mean? I want to die. I don't want to be ridiculous when
okay,
I die.
Okay, how would you like to die?
I'd like to die making love to my wife.
Okay.
I know that's probably not good for her.
No, no. But as long as you're on top, I don't see that as a problem. Okay, so...
Well, then it is a problem because I'm never on top.
That's a
I'm
bigger problem.
I'm usually underneath the quilt that has a hole in it. That is a problem. But that's the way I'd like to go.
Okay. So I can give you a blood thinner, Lipitor, and then I'll give you Klonopin. Now you got to promise me that you take a bottle of wine before you go and have sex with your wife. All right?
Okay.
You will be awake for 5, 7, 8 minutes. All right? This altered state. In that altered state, there's your opportunity to have sex. You have a very small window. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Okay? All right.
Can you give me some type of something for my penis?
Yes, I can. Now, I'm going to tell you this.
Because I'm already going to be
okay.
Anxious.
I understand.
Thinking about, like, I got to get my wife off in 5 minutes.
I can give you a very therapeutic dose of...
Cialis?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay? But I'm going to warn you. When they take your body out, you're going to have an erection.
Oh,
okay?
See, that's going to be embarrassing, too.
I'm just...
Being wheeled out and, you know, pitching a tent there in front of all the orderlies and stuff. Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to be a fool when I die.
No, no, you don't.
I don't want to be laughed at when
no,
I'm dead.
No,
so I don't want to poo in my pants.
No, you don't want an
erection.
I don't
erection. Want to have a boner.
No.
Sorry, I have to use
no,
that
it's term. All right. We use it in medical school.
Okay.
Not in front of patients, but I know what you mean, right?
Yeah.
You know?
So then I guess we're going to have to figure out a way that the erection will go away before
Well,
I
that's
die.
Where... Okay. So if you take a muscle... Wow. If you take 2 muscle relaxers, but you have to remember that during sex, by the time they come and get your body, you will not have an erection.
Perfect. Is that like...
That was a lot of fun. I didn't think we were going to start in the chairs, but it seems like that's something that you like to do.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Chairs are always the best way to go.
But I actually thought we were going to get up and do the scene. So for people that are listening on the podcast, we sat in these chairs and did not get up at all.
Yes. I wanted to prove to this audience that you don't have to move a lot to improvise.
Okay.
The space was all clear in my mind.
Okay.
I knew where the x-ray was.
Mm-hmm.
I knew where the picture was of the human body. It all was all there.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have to get up and do jumping jacks.
Okay. I was thrown at the beginning. I was like, oh, well, okay, we're starting. We're already going into it. So that threw me off a little. What did you think of it, the improv part?
Well, the thing I thought initially was this is great because so many scenes are doctor scenes.
Right.
And all of them do. And that, I reference this because everyone does that.
Right.
Everyone snaps a, right. an x-ray into
they,
the thing.
A doctor scene, they start out and they put the x-ray. Yeah.
Yeah. So 90% of improv scenes, because of the chairs, are doctor's offices, psychiatrist's office, or mm-hmm. or inappropriate restaurant.
Right. Why do you think that is?
Why do I think what is?
That they... improvised scenes go to that place.
Because it's easier, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's easier to just start and get to a kind of a fun place to play instead of worrying too much about the physical. A lot of times people will start like, they'll jump on the floor and they'll be handing machine guns.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, that's a lot. That's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So what's kind of fun for me is getting into like just the conversations as much as like writing a sketch. It's kind of fun just to find what we discover.
Now, you've come from three different schools, IO, Second City, UCB, all different in their approach. What do you take from each school?
From Second City style, it's very slow. And then like you develop, you let things develop, and that's kind of what I was doing here, as opposed to a UCB style, which is more we're writing it on our feet, you know. So in UCB style is more like in the first three sentences, there's going to be a setup of what the joke's going to be, and usually it's like if it's you and I improvising, we'll both say something. And you'll either go with where I'm going or I'll go where you're going. But it'll be a little more set as compared to a Second City sketch, which is more like, let's just see what happens.
Make the discoveries
yeah.
about the characters. It's more character-based.
Yeah. And I think that's UCB's is to just start out with mm-hmm. your point of view already.
Great. We're going to take some questions from the audience. Okay, about what we just did, or about your career, or about you, or about...
Whatever you want, oh, yeah.
You're open for anything.
Yeah, okay, anything.
Okay, anything.
Anything.
Okay, great. Great. Back here.
Yes, I just recently discovered...
Could you stand up, please, so we could hear you? And what's your name?
I'm Alex.
Hi, Alex.
Hi, Alex. Yeah, I had a character that couldn't stop coming from his mouth.
Is there a question?
I think it was Tissue Tommy, and so I had to have a tissue in my mouth constantly.
Right.
Yeah, this is a very good character. Yes. Thank you. That is like what I've really been enjoying about podcasts. Also with the people that you're listening to, they're all very experienced, you know, like we've been doing it for like 15 years. So, and we all kind of have a similar sense of humor. So when people go like, wow, you guys are real good at improvising. It's mostly just because we're very familiar with each other. Like I've been working with Matt for years and years.
Matt Besser.
Matt Besser. Yeah. And the podcast offers you an ability to do whatever you want. And there's no one that's going to tell you, don't do that. So there's very freeing. So if you find that it's a little more interesting than most things, it's because it's unfiltered. So that's probably why it's good.
Great. Another question?
Great question.
Right here.
Hi there, I'm Sam.
Hey, Sam.
Hey, Raj. Can I call you Raj?
Yeah, you can.
Why do people call you Raj, by the way?
Because when I was little, Horacio was hard to tell people. Like, it was hard for people to pronounce. That's my name, Horacio. In Spanish, GH is silent.
Okay.
And so I'd be like, I'm Horacio. And they'd be like, Horacio? Horacio? And so I was just like, just call me Tony. And I went through periods where I was Tony, Frank, and Roger. Roger was one that stuck because someone came to my house looking for me as Roger.
And then it just became Raj.
And then it became Raj.
Yes, Sam.
Okay. It seemed to me, just watching SNL, that you and Jimmy Fallon in particular seem to have quite a connection, a friendship. And I've always wanted to know, what is it like working with him? And is... I think he can hear me.
Is I think that, that's for the rest of the audience.
Yes. So. Is that friendship with Fallon genuine, and do you guys still hold that still kind of close relationship?
Yeah, it's something we don't really talk about. Like, we know that, I know that we just like each other. We make each other laugh. When we started together, we started at the same time, and that was pretty clear, like, from the beginning. He'll call me every once in a while. And you know, he'll be like, we got to get together, man. Like, he'll be drunk or something calling me. And so when I go to New York, I usually stop by the show and say hi. And I did the show a couple weeks ago. But, yeah, that's like a genuine fun thing that I discovered. Just we just had a connection. And really, that laughing, a lot of that laughing was just trying to make the other person laugh.
Well, I had read that you guys would, there'd be lines that you wouldn't do in the dress rehearsal, and you'd hold back. And then when you went to do it, You would hold lines back for the live taping to make each other laugh. Is that
yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of what led to. There's one scene where we pretty much improvised most of it, which is Osama bin Laden
with the phone.
Yeah, with the phone.
Yeah,
yeah. And so he was doing insults that he hadn't done before, and so then I had to make up some insults that he hadn't heard before. And it's a very rare occasion where that scene's mostly improvised, and it's pretty cool.
Are you? I'm the most jealous person there is, you know. And I've been open that I'm jealous of Tina Fey and anybody else who's from Chicago. What's going on? How do you deal with people that go on, like a Jimmy Fallon or something like that? Are you okay with people's success?
Well, I totally am.
Okay.
I wasn't always.
Okay. How did you get over it? Because I need help.
Well, you know, for many years, including all the times I was at Second City and drinking, it was my whole life. Comedy was my whole life. Like, I didn't really have relationships, and everything else suffered for it. But now, like, I have a life, and I appreciate my life and other things about it. So I just realized that those people being successful, they're not stopping me from being successful. Like, they're not keeping me from having a show. I'm keeping myself from having a show. So if you just look at it that way, that... we're all just human beings going to the next level. Like, being Tina Fey won't make you happy. It'll make you rich. but you know, you just have to realize that stuff doesn't make you happy. Like, I did the Pete Holmes podcast, and he was asking, like, what's it like? You know, your friends are famous. And I'm like, well, yeah, I'm happy for them. That's awesome. But I don't feel jealous. Like, I didn't get it. I didn't get my chance. I just feel, you know.
Do you ever, and my wife is crazy when I say this, because Alex goes, well, what made Tina Fey or what made Stephen Colbert? You know, what is it that makes them different or whatever? Do you ever go there, like, trying to figure out what's the thing that makes them successful?
yeah. And
what have you come up with?
What I feel is that they've been able to tap into, like, a mainstream audience easier than I was able to. And
do you think you resist that?
That?
Do you think you resist that?
Probably. But also, Tina Fey is like the hardest working person I know. So I'm not prepared to work that hard. And Jimmy also. I mean, Jimmy's in that building 14 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I envy his position, but also I'd rather just not work that hard.
Great. Let's take another question. Oh, my God, we have so many. Right over here.
Me?
Yes, you. What is your
You're
name?
You're next, don't worry.
We'll get to you guys.
Hi, my name is Brenna, and I'm just really interested to know what your audition experience was for SNL.
I told this story earlier. Ann heard it. I'll tell it again. Sorry, Ann. But Tina came back.
Tina Fey.
Tina Fey came back to Second City on one of her off weeks, and her husband was the musical director for my shows at ETC. So we were pretty close. And I went for a walk with her, and I told her, like, I want to leave. I kind of want to leave Second City because I'd done three shows there, and I was kind of feeling like my friends had left, and I wasn't really going anywhere, although I was having fun at ETC. And then she said, well, if you leave, there's no place I can send the producers. And that really resonated. Like, I could have gone to New York or L.A., but then I wouldn't have been in as good a situation. Like, my situation ETC, I wrote most of the sketches I was in, and I sang, I did voices. So it was like a really good audition. So I stayed. I finished a show, and then they said that they came and saw me and said that in a few months there'll be auditions. So I had a few months to write and prepare my audition.
And you went, and then they brought you out there to audition?
They flew me out. I changed the flight so that I could come out earlier, so I could be in the city, because I knew that the city was intimidating.
And you were living with your parents at the time,
I was living with my parents.
Okay, so this is a big
it's
deal.
A big, yeah.
And you're 29, right?
At 28 at the time.
Okay.
And, yeah, I lived with my parents till I was 28. I'd probably still be with my parents if it wasn't for SNL. I think the great thing is that I had 2 months to write it. And so I would be backstage at SNL, at Second City and ETC, writing it, performing it. I had Jeff come in a couple times to give me notes. And he was like, the audition's really great. When he said that, I was pretty confident. And then I got a tape of Koechner.
Dave Koechner.
Dave
yeah.
Koechner's
who had
audition.
Who had gotten hired a couple of years before, right?
Yeah. And I asked Adam McKay, like, whose audition was really good, and could I get a copy of it? And he sent me Dave's, and it was really good. But again, I was like, oh, I can do something like this, you know? So.
Which is like three characters and three impressions, basically, right?
Yeah. And I didn't really do impressions until I got on the show. So I kind of had to make some up. I could always sing like Ozzy. So the Ozzy impression came mostly from singing, and then I had to kind of go back and do the voice. And Meatloaf was just singing. And I did a character that sounded like Robert Stack from Unsolved Mysteries.
Can you give us a little sample?
Yeah, but I made a character, right? So it wasn't Robert Stack, but a guy that sounded like Robert Stack.
Okay.
So it'd be like, hello? Yes, this is me. Look, if you have any reason to believe that you're talking to Robert Stack, you're talking to the wrong person. And so it was just basically a guy who was being harassed by his neighbors because he talked like Robert Stack.
Great, let's take another question. Oh, my God, we have so many right here.
Oh, this girl here was disappointed.
Could you stand up, please?
Yeah.
What is your name? I'm sorry?
Kearney.
Hi, Kearney.
Kearney.
I'm not going to get it.
Jesus.
That's everybody says.
They're giving you the microphone now.
Feels so important. I have a question about the scene that you guys just did.
Yes.
About what?
The scene we just did.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The doctor scene, the famous doctor scene.
Thank you.
When you had earlier said that you were thinking about things that could go wrong in a deli, and then the doctor, you said that, like, he was smoking, you kind of looked, like, pissed. Were you mad? Like, is that a problem being an improviser? Like, your preconceived notions and people, like, do you just try not to have them? Because I know that they happen to everybody anyway.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm trying to understand what you're saying. Like, it seemed like I was angry when he said I was smoking.
Yeah, because I feel like you were maybe thinking of, like, a deli-related injury for being at the doctor.
Yeah.
And then he said that you were, like, a smoker. And so you were kind of like, yes. So like,
oh yeah. Well, I was just playing the fact that if I was a guy who smoked, which I am, mm-hmm. I'd be ashamed of it.
Yeah.
And so I was just playing like, I don't want to talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about deli meats. But I wasn't really angry. I was more just like playing.
Do you have like a problem with that though, or did you ever like going in with preconceived notions to like in a scene?
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes people will not be on the same page with you. That's to put it nicely. You know, sometimes people don't know that that's the game or that that's where you should go. But that happens less and less the more you improvise.
Yeah, and I think, too, is you part of doing it for so long is you realize that you for this to go forward, someone's going to have to give in. And you're going to have
yeah.
the quicker you can give in and say, okay, I'm going with your idea, you know, the better.
Yes and is always a great way to start, but I think once you kind of know where you're going, you could always ask questions. Like I asked you a question,
right.
Knowing that you probably don't hear questions too often because it's a no-no.
Right.
But it's part of language, so.
Yeah, that's like a part of everyday life.
And yeah.
People say, like, don't deny. Like, you're going to say no and sometimes, but, yeah.
So you can deny but also have something ready to go.
Like, yeah, like back
not up. Bye, I'm leaving.
Yeah.
Great,
yeah.
Let's get in a couple more questions.
Thank you.
Right here. Yes, you in the blue shirt. Yes, yeah.
My name's Corey.
Hi, Corey.
I'm wondering if the character Carol, you know a Carol or someone that's like Carol, was based off anyone, or you just came up with it?
Tell us a little for people who don't know Carol from Saturday Night Live.
Well, Carol was written by Seth Meyers as a. It was a scene about wife swapping. You know, there was that movie where people would put their keys in a bowl, and then you'd end up. Swapping. So we played a sketch where I was Colin Farrell's wife, Carol. And I was very gross and loud, and we drink a lot. And so part of the character was that I always spiked fun drinks, like 7-Eleven coffee drinks. I would put some kind of odd liquor inside them. And I was very open sexually. And so, like, that, the character started out as a scene, and then we kind of took Carol off, and it was just basically me being inappropriate with men.
Was it based on somebody you knew?
It wasn't. But everyone, a lot of people were like, I know where you got that. And they'd be, that's from her. I'm like,
great, let's take another question. Right here. Yeah. We're just waiting for the microphone to get to you. Yes.
Hi, my name is Alana. I just had a question about the character Rick that was one of like the most, I don't know, iconic SNL moments growing up for me. Whose idea was that, and how could you do that with Amy Poehler? That's ridiculous.
Well, you know,
tell us a little about that sketch.
Amy Poehler plays this little rambunctious girl. And I'm her stepfather, and so, and she's just going crazy, and I imagined what I would want to see the character be, because if you think of a little girl and a stepfather, in the world of comedy, it's usually something inappropriate's happening. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, that's where comedically you go first.
Uh-huh.
But I was thinking, I want to be the person that I would want. To see, deal with Amy. So he never gets truly mad at her. Like he's very forgiving and he's a sweet guy. Because in my mind, her mother was just terrible, like a drunk, like maybe working at a gas station. When you saw the scenes, she was just out somewhere because you never saw the mother. And so for me, I was the only kind of stable thing in her life. And it was kind of a... Just being with Amy was very much like our relationship anyway.
Which is what?
Which is like,
cause you
she's
got...
very funny and like I like to see her play, but it doesn't make me laugh. So you know.
Wait, I don't get that. It doesn't make you laugh.
Like I'm not going to be laughing out loud like when people are doing bits.
Mm-hmm.
But when with Amy, like I would let her get the moment. You know, I would facilitate her being funny more than me being funny. And I think that really worked for the sketch.
Great. Let's take another question. Right there in the red shirt.
Red Wing Johnny over here.
I know there's a lot of like comedy studies people here, and I was just curious for your like early years, if you could go back, like time travel, and give yourself some advice for the years up ahead, especially leading to Second City and beyond that, what would you tell yourself? Sounds like a bad M. Night Shyamalan movie, but...
Yeah. I guess I would remind myself earlier that it wasn't that important. Like, I think I could have learned things from life a little sooner. I think I was kind of arrested because I had such tunnel vision about what I wanted to do. I think I would tell myself to like relax a little.
Did you enjoy it going
back in time?
Yes.
Just now?
Yes. How was it?
It was great.
What year did you land on?
What?
What year did you land on?
I think 92.
Because I was going to say 87, but let's take another question. Oh, my God, we have so many. Right here.
Hi, I'm Mike.
Hi, Mike.
Why don't you stand up? Don't worry about the microphone. Yeah. I want to get as many questions as we can get in.
You kind of just segued into this. Did you have any like specific goals in mind while you were at Second City? Like, is it always your dream to be on stage? /SNL/...
Yeah, I basically wanted to follow those guys that I grew up watching. And so, like, when I was little, I would go to Second City and kind of, like, grab the doorknobs, you know? I remember taking the North Avenue bus and just being like, this is where those guys went in, you know, with the faces.
Right,
Second
above
City.
Yeah.
It's very magical. Even now, to go in there, like, it just really makes me happy. And so, I'm sorry, what was the question?
If you had specific goals.
Specific goals. Yeah, basically just to do what I did. Like, I don't...
So when you were in Second City, you got a resident stage at ETC, you weren't thinking of SNL at that time.
Yeah, I was.
So it evolved. Like when you first got hired, you weren't thinking of SNL, or were you?
I was always thinking about SNL, but you kind of put it aside and you got to get to the work at hand.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's crazy to just be like, I want to be on SNL, so what do I got to do to get there faster? So you just immerse yourself in the work, knowing that that's eventually what could happen. So I just basically knew I was at the right place. I felt really good about the time I was there and when I was there and how it was happening. So I didn't, the goal was always there, and it was just like, well, now you're going to have to deal with this. So just do this as good as you can, and it'll come.
Great. Great. Right over there? Yes.
I think it's like having tools. Eventually, you're going to be competing with other people, and they'll be funny. But if you have a better understanding of writing a scene, like if you start writing scenes now, by the time you're going to be asked to write scenes, you'll be a lot better than just starting. Like when I started at Second City, I literally just started writing then. And so now you have the opportunity to learn how to write. You have an opportunity to learn how to act. So you're just going into the arena with more tools. And I think get all you can right now, and it'll just absorb as much as you can, and it'll just make you that much more prepared later.
Right here.
Hi, my name is Brielle.
Hi.
So with comedy becoming this increasingly popular art form for, you know, aspiring performers, I find that it's really easy to fall into the rut where you're just another stand-up comedian at an open mic, or you're just another improv group performing a show on the north side. So with that in mind, what's a way that you can make yourself stand out more, or your team stand out more with comedy being so popular?
Well, when we started the Upright Citizens Brigade, which became UCB, our goal was just to be different and not to, you kind of have a, not a disdain, I guess that's a hard word, but you have a certain lack of respect. I was saying this earlier. Like, you just, you like, if we would have started in thinking that Second City is the greatest comedic place, it would have been intimidating. Instead, for some reason, we kind of felt that, yeah, we deserve to be at Second City. It was like our right because of the work we'd done before. So what I would say is just stay away from those things that are simple and easy. We all know what those things are. And to differentiate yourself, it was all about trying to do comedy in a different way.
But it was something you guys were passionate about that you didn't think was being served in Chicago at that time.
Yeah, it wasn't being served anywhere, really. I mean, so we were just trying to change the game and be interesting. But I would say the most important thing is to really just we know what's funny and we know what we like. Like I started out trying to be John Belushi, and so you know a lot of my education was trying to step away from that and to be a little different, or even just my own performer. I think that you should watch people that are good to see what they're doing, but you should always be striving to kind of show a different side of that's not been seen. Yeah.
Great. We've got time for a couple more. Right here.
Hi, I'm Ashley. I was curious if you ever regretted not graduating college, and then what brought you to the point where you decided that you wanted to leave it?
Yeah, I think I kind of should have probably finished, but... But I can't. I mean, I can't say that was the wrong decision, because the people that I happened to run into when I quit, you know, Adam McKay and Adam and the Matts,
Matt Walsh and Matt Besser,
Ian. Yeah, all those people.
Ian Robert,
you know, if I had stayed in school, I would have missed them, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because I quit and I was performing with them at bars, basically, you know, we'd hang out after shows and we were becoming friends and we were becoming a group outside of the stage. So I would like to have graduated and maybe had something else to do, but it ended up working, and I can't say that I would change anything.
Great. Way back there.
Hi, my name is Rachel. I actually currently tour with Second City.
Kelly's here.
Okay.
I'll introduce you to him later.
In the hubbub.
Yeah.
Well, I just think that it's a very collaborative effort, and if you go in feeling that you have to serve that effort, my only concern was that the scenes I was in, that they would be good for me, like that they were fun for me to do, and if there were scenes that I didn't like that other people were doing, you know, I didn't enjoy it. But I also wouldn't be like, I would be a little more accepting of it. But as long as I was taking care of myself, I felt everyone else had a right to do their thing. And I think eventually you're either right or you're wrong. And I think I was right. And so as long as you take care of yourself and you're honest with yourself, all the other things that are happening on the stage they're out of your control anyway. So really, it's more of a simple thing of just take care of yourself, and you have to be collaborative and accepting of other people's ideas, obviously, but it wasn't my main concern. If something wasn't funny and someone really wanted to do it, you know, the audience would tell them eventually that it wasn't good. So, you know, things kind of end up taking care of themselves.
Great. Right over here.
Alec, as you transitioned out of college to the Chicago comedy scene, how did you fund your journey?
I lived at home, which was different from a lot of people. Most of the people I knew were just out of college and were like just on their own for the first time. I just had like a part-time job at like a dating service. And eventually I became an indentured servant at Second City because we used to get free liquor. You remember this? Yeah. And so, like, I would go to the Monday night shows and watch to understudy. Like, I'd watch, but I'd get drunk a lot.
But you were really going to supplement your income.
Yeah, yeah. And then, so eventually, when I did start touring, they would charge you for the beer. So you'd get a check, and it was, like, $80. And then it would be, like, $30 because you drank $50 worth of beer. So, yeah. So a lot of times we're...
Can we talk about talk about your weight loss for just a second?
Yeah.
Okay. So you lost 100 pounds. You said John Belushi was your idol. And I lost a ton of weight too. And it was such a loss. I mean, it was like my whole identity.
Yeah.
And you were known as kind of the fat, funny guy, the Chris Farley, the John Belushi type. How have you been able to adjust to that?
Not to be too dark, but those guys died. You know, and so I was following their path.
Is that what motivated you to lose the weight?
Yeah. Yeah, I was getting to a place where I was getting, I was going to a doctor and they were saying, like, your blood pressure is very high, you have to take medicine. You're, like, borderline diabetic. Like, these things were coming up.
So the doctor scene wasn't too far off?
No.
You'd laugh or not take it seriously?
Right.
Okay.
I would just take pills and be like, it's fine, I'm taking pills.
Yeah. I'm 300 pounds, but I'm taking pills.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm taking care of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I'm seeing a doctor every 2 months, making sure I'm not going to die. But that was the thing. Those guys, I basically followed their path, and I loved them, and I thought they were amazing, but I knew kind of where it would end. And I just decided that I didn't want to do that.
And so losing all that weight and not being the fat, funny guy, did you have to adjust your comedy?
Not really. I think people have had to adjust their perceptions of me. But it's not from a different place necessarily.
You don't go home. God, if I was still 260 or whatever you were, I'd get more parts. Do you ever?
It doesn't matter to me really. I'd rather not. I'd rather be healthy than to be in a part and be close to death.
One piece of advice you'd give people starting out today?
This has only come up today, but there's so much about people doing YouTube videos and kind of writing your own way out. And I think that people should be patient and learn while they're here. This is the place where they should do it. Because I think people think, I'll just do a YouTube video, it'll be funny and I'll be famous. And if you might be, but there'll be a lack of stuff inside, And so I think that do all the natural things that you're supposed to do. Learn all these things you can do, and then do the videos, and then go out to LA, so that when you're competing against these people, you have more than just. I got a lot of followers on YouTube, so I'm good. I think if you learn how to act and you improvise and you do all the things that. That are available to you right now, it'll just make you a better performer.
Horatio Sands, thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. There you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can, the Horatio Sands interview. As you know, we don't number our interviews over here because somebody isn't very good with numbers, that being me. I want to thank our guest today, Horatio Sands. It was so great to see him and talk to him. I hadn't seen him in a long time. And I especially want to thank all the good people at my alma mater, Columbia College, Chicago.
As always, I want to thank my producer, Ben Caprero. He's the guy who makes it sound so slick and so professional. You've probably figured this out because my audience is super smart. We are on feralaudio.com, and we're not there alone. There's some other cool people like Chelsea Peretti and Todd Berry and Steve Agee and Brain Warp the Baby Eater and Matt Dwyer. They all have podcasts on there, so check it out. It's not a corporation. It's a collective. And if you're feeling a little generous, especially around the holidays now, hit the donate button for Improv Nerd and see if some of the money comes back our way. That's feralaudio.com. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes, The Art of Slow Comedy, and my Improv Nerd blog, which will give you amazing tips for you to become a better improviser, go to JimmyCorain.com. That's JimmyCorain.com. If you want me to come to your college or your improv theater across the country, you can contact me. I'll bring an Improv Nerd show. I'll also do a series of my award-winning workshops. You can just contact me at JimCorain@gmail.com. And please, 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 I know I'm begging you, like our Improv Nerd fan page on Facebook. It really helps with my low self-esteem. And thank you for listening and all your wonderful and kind emails over the week. I really appreciate it. It helps me keep going. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Let's say Seinfeld was on an island, and he was blowing Boris Karloff. What would that be like?
And it might go something like this. Oh, Mr. Karloff, I loved you in Frankenstein, and I love giving you a blowjob. Why, Mr. Seinfeld, I love having you